You've got about almost 100 employees who basically are on a list where they know they're going to be laid off but can't be laid off yet because the union and the leadership haven't reached this agreement, and therefore they're just sort of like sitting around either not writing or not doing much, waiting for what they the inevitable day when they know that they will be laid off.
Welcome to the Powers That Be Daily, Puck's podcast focused on the intersection of Wall Street, Washington, Silicon Valley, and Hollywood, and the players who run it all. I'm Peter Hamby. It's Thursday, March 21st. Today, I'm joined by Dylan Byers to talk about the ongoing friction at Condé Nast between management and labor, and why tensions between company leaders and their frustrated employees keep boiling over as Condé struggles to navigate the digital future. We also dig into Elon Musk's plans to pay big names to host shows on his pet platform X, and why that roadmap suddenly looks pretty bumpy after the firing of Don Lemon. We'll discuss all that and much, much more on today's episode of The Powers That Be. Quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, accessed from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. You improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move, so do the math. See how you profit with NetSuite. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/powersthatbe, netsuite.com/powersthatbe. That's netsuite.com/powersthatbe. Happy Thursday, everybody. Welcome to The Powers That Be. We here in Puckland. Some of us are probably nursing a little headache after partying last night at the French ambassador's residence. In spite of that, I'm joined today by Dylan Byers, who knows as a sophisticated drinker when to call it a night. He knows his cocktails. He knows his limits. He knows his tolerance. So Dylan is here to talk to me today about troubles at Condé Nast. Dylan, great to see you last night. How you doing, buddy?
I'm okay. I may know my limits, but it doesn't mean I abide by them. You know, my great mistake. So you may have noticed, Peter, that there were boulevardiers on the cocktail menu last night, which was my great idea because I thought there was some poetry to the fact that the guy who invented that drink a century ago was an American journalist in Paris. And it seemed appropriate given that our venue was the French ambassador's residence and that we were honoring the First Amendment, but maybe a heavily spirited cocktail with a brown liquor base was not the right avenue to go in terms of being terribly productive on a Thursday morning.
That is a good call. Brown liquor always gets people. It is, though, a beautiful week in Washington. Spring is trying to get out. You know, even us Angelinos here in LA can recognize the beauty of spring in Washington, I got to admit. Dylan, I did want to talk to you about Condé Nast. They continue to struggle with labor disputes. This is a storied media brand that has run into obvious trouble in recent years as the media world and the magazine world has migrated to digital. Give us the latest. Like, I feel like every single time I have, you know, John on Media Monday, or I talk to you, or every other time at least, we're talking about a restive employee base pushing back against the bosses at Condé and possible layoffs and just general anxiety
at that place. What's going on?
Yeah, well, you're certainly right. I mean, I think like the it would be more than enough for these executives to have to deal with the sort of, you know, macroeconomic headwinds that they're facing. Whether you're talking about the magazine industry, the television industry, what have you, newspaper industry. Alas, they also have to deal with these increasingly vocal, active unions who are feeling particularly emboldened, I think, in recent years, just in terms of the sort of like political environment. And in the case of Condé Nast, this has sort of manifested itself in this like months long fight where the union keeps sort of like showing up and not and making demands that probably go a step or two too far in terms of being reasonable. And the executive leadership responds in the sort of most ham-fisted way. And so, for instance, at Condé Nast, the most recent sort of affront in the eyes of the union is you have CEO Roger Lynch goes out, gives an interview in which he says that there will be no more layoffs at the company, and then comes back this week and writes a letter to the union saying that they are going to have to lay more people off or pursue more cuts because these contract negotiations are taking so long. On top of that, you've got, because Roger has not reached an agreement with Vanity Fair and a few other titles, he can't actually lay those people off. So while there were layoffs at the New Yorker and other titles back in the fall, at Vanity Fair, what you have is you have a group of journalists, I think across the magazines that have not yet reached an agreement. You've got about almost 100 employees who basically are on a list where they know they're going to be laid off but can't be laid off yet because the union and the leadership haven't reached this agreement, and therefore they're just sort of like sitting around either not writing or not doing much, waiting for what the inevitable day when they know that they will be laid off. And as a sort of response to this sort of, you know, like absurdity, the members of the union are now spamming Roger Lynch and Anna Wintour's inbox with emails. This happened on Tuesday with just like dozens and dozens and dozens of emails with sort of what one source described as like Gen Z sass, basically like blowing them up for their mishandling of all this. And I think one of the reasons, look, there are, to your point, union fights across the industry, across many industries. I think one of the reasons that this one is so near and dear to our hearts, and certainly one that you and John and I enjoy talking about, is like we're talking about Condé Nast. We're talking about like the prestige magazine publisher behind Vogue, Vanity Fair, The New Yorker. Mm-hmm. How did it get to this, right? Like how did it get to the point where Anna Wintour, who simultaneously, you know, is out on like every runway and at every fashion week and is sort of the grand dame of the industry, how is that the same company that is dealing with this just like this circus down on the ground floor? And it is in many ways sort of like it sort of epitomizes this very, very strange moment, this transitional moment in media when the decline seems to be is being managed very poorly, it seems to me, and the union voices have never been more vocal or more willing to cause trouble. And every time I talk to my sources at Condé Nast, New Yorker, Vanity Fair, whatever, it always comes back to one thing, which is just sort of a big shrug of the shoulders and a like, man, what a sad and depressing state of affairs.
I obviously believe that news guilds and unions representing writers have a right to speak out and demand fair wages, workplace practices, insurance, etc. It's a difficult argument to make in an era when the revenues of these places are shrinking and news organizations and media companies are dying off left and right in the digital space. It doesn't seem productive for those Gen Z staffers to be spamming their inboxes, though. That feels like something that could backfire. You know, like if you're management, you might just be like, what? This is not like you specifically, person who's sending your email. I can see your name. It's right there in my inbox. I can see your name. Like, I don't think you're going to be at the company much longer. And look, maybe some of those people think they won't be at the company much longer, so might as well burn it all down on the way out. But John Kelly would, I think, agree with what I'm about to say, though, which is newsrooms, television, magazine, print, digital, whatever. One thing they've always been afflicted by is that unlike other businesses, MBA types aren't coming in to be the managers. The people who end up being managers in news organizations are journalists, former journalists, you know, people who have become editors over the years. You know, there are obviously business sides to every media company, but oftentimes the people who are in charge of hiring, firing, managing, career growth, those are just people who are journalists. And those are not the kind of people who are very well equipped to deal with labor disputes. I'm reading this fat history book right now called American Colossus by H.W. Brands about how capitalism conquered America, like, you know, after the Civil War. And I'm currently in the midst of the railroad barons, like, crushing labor disputes in, like, Pennsylvania in the 1870s, you know, just total ruthless shit, not to be endorsed. But the capitalist business side of our economy has always dealt with labor and had to deal with it. Like, news organizations, one, have the problem of management that probably might not be best suited to handle labor disputes. And two, like, the rise of unionized media people is also, like, a relatively new thing. Like, that wasn't really something that existed when I first started working at CNN, for example, in, like, 2005. It existed on the, in TV, it existed on the production side, like, sat truck operators and camera guys and stuff. They were unionized at various places, but, like, actual journalists being organized into unions, that's something that is also kind of new.
Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, the union, you're right about the increase in both, I think, union representation and just sort of the vocalness and vociferousness of the of those unions. I mean, I think like the Washington Post, something like more than 2/3 of union eligible staff are union members. It's gotten to be pretty big. To your point about the executives, historically that was true. I think one thing we're seeing now is that, and perhaps this explains some of the revulsion again down on the ground floor, is that increasingly, the people who are being brought in to manage these companies are not journalists historically, right? I mean, you think about it, like Roger Lynch, I think, came to Condé from Pandora. And you think, you know, you think right. about, and we write about it a lot, but there are now a lot of MBA types who are being brought in to manage these companies. And they are increasingly thinking about things in terms of the bottom line, in terms of managing the P&L. Mm-hmm. And part of the tension, I think, that exists between the unions and the leadership at a lot of these media companies is, on the one hand, just that the business has become harder and less forgiving, certainly. But two is that the leadership is no longer telegraphing the sort of romantic, you know, idealistic notions of journalism, and they are by no means doing much to sort of soften the blow. I mean, certainly in the case of Condé Nast, a lot of this is sort of like a PR failure, right? Or at least an internal communications failure. You think about what happened to Pitchfork, right? Like, they basically, they did not do well by Pitchfork. Condé Nast did not. But when they announced what they announced, they basically made it sound like everyone was going to be laid off and the site was going to be shuttered, right? They didn't even try to basically, like, you know, assuage people by saying that Pitchfork would continue to live on as a vertical over at GQ. Mm-hmm. Going out and saying there won't be any more layoffs and then writing an internal memo this week in which it sounds like 5 more people are going to be added to the layoff list. Like, what are you doing? Why are you doing that? It just seems bungled across the board. And yet, look, I agree with you. Unions can be a very effective, productive thing, but right now in the news industry, they seem to be causing so many headaches for so many institutions, and it is the bane of every media executive or editorial leader I know that the job, again, is hard enough without this, and to be bogged down in a labor dispute is sort of the most... I think to them, it feels like it's adding insult to injury, particularly when the demands of the union don't seem to be reasonable.
All right, Dylan, I want to take a quick break and then talk to you about a couple of people who are not in a union, to my knowledge. Elon Musk and Don Lemon and their ongoing dispute after only a very brief time there as one of X's new hosts on the platform. I want to ask you about where both of them go from here after the break. Are you tired of sleeping hotter than hell? I sure am. I sleep hot. There's something crucial about sleep that eludes us when we're too warm, too uncomfortable, and too caught in the web of our own thoughts to drift off. And while curiosity fuels our days, science tells us that cool sleep recharges our nights. That's where Chili Pad by Sleep Me comes in. Meet the bed cooling system that elevates the quality of human life through cool sleep. The Chili Pad bed cooling system is your new bedtime solution. I love it. It lets you customize your sleeping environment to your optimal temperature, ensuring you fall asleep, stay asleep, and wake up refreshed. Chili Pad works with your existing mattress. It's a water-based mattress topper that continuously controls your bed temperature from 55 to 115 degrees, allowing your body to rest and recover. This isn't just about escaping the heat, it's also about optimizing your sleep for better health, more energy, and improved physical and cognitive performance, which I obviously need hosting a podcast. Chili Pads are designed for one or two sleepers, so if your sleep partner likes to sleep at a different temperature, or you only need it for one side of the bed, that's okay too, and we know that's crucial. Plus, you can schedule automated temperature changes to trigger deep sleep. But when I'm at home, Chili Pad solves those problems. So trust me on this one. Visit sleep.me/powers to get your Chili Pad and save up to $315 with code POWERS. This offer is available exclusively for Powers That Be listeners and only for a limited time. Order it today with free shipping and try it out for 30 days. You can return it for free if you don't like it with their sleep trial. Visit www.sleep.me/powers because you're not just investing in better sleep, you're creating a better life.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Welcome back to the Powers That Be, everybody. I'm talking with Dylan Byers about media, of course. We're talking about labor unions in the A block, somebody who hates labor unions. Elon Musk, famously an enemy of labor forces trying to organize Tesla. Dylan, Don Lemon was booted from X a couple weeks ago now after being one of several hosts, personalities hired to start shows on Twitter. Tucker Carlson was obviously the first, Tulsi Gabbard, Jim Rome, the sports dude, and then Don Lemon, probably some other names I'm forgetting. They're basically being given checks directly from Twitter to post their content on X, host shows there. For people who don't know, if you listen to this podcast and you don't know, welcome to the show for the first time. But Don Lemon was basically, it seems, fired after he sat with Elon for a lengthy interview and, to Don's great credit, didn't pull punches with his new boss and asked him about, you know, rumors about his drug use and, you know, Twitter as a business and how it suffered under Musk's leadership, et cetera, et cetera. Boom, turned around, gone. Don is now posting his interview elsewhere. He can make money on different platforms now, obviously. But Dylan, the question I wanted to ask you is, like, where does this leave the other show hosts? Is there, you know, this felt like kind of an ad hoc strategic decision to host these shows in the first place. But like, I know Jim Rome isn't going to be asking Elon Musk about like the New York Rangers. and Tulsi Gabbard feels like somebody who will probably be more sycophantic to Elon than Don was. Where does this leave these show hosts on X? Is it just going to be like a handful of folks?
Yeah, you know, so you and I have talked a lot about the dawn of it all, right? Like, what did he do? What happens to him? Can you build a business on your own as a former cable news star? Mm-hmm. But what's so sort of interesting is that for a time, it seemed like the one venue in which that could ostensibly happen, where you could get some guaranteed money up front and then also make some money on the back end through, you know, ad revenue sharing or whatever. That, for a brief moment, seemed like it was actually going to be a business that Elon Musk and Linda Yaccarino, the CEO, wanted to get into. And indeed, the reason that they brought, they sort of like rushed to get Don Lemon's name into the announcement so that Linda Yaccarino could go to CES and say, look, we are creating a home for content creators like Don Lemon and Jim Rome and Tulsi Gabbard. Advertisers, please come over. It's not just Tucker Carlson, you know, going to like a Moscow shopping mart. It's like we've got a range of personalities, and we even have journalists. And it was like it was a signal to the advertising community and a signal also to the creative community that this was going to be a meaningful piece of the X business. And I think, having gone back and watched the interview and spoken to people, you know, in sort of Don's orbit and in the sort of Elon Linda X orbit, it seems to me like what happened there is Elon was literally sitting in the middle of the interview and was getting questions about his drug use and his politics and anti-Semitism that he didn't really like. And then more generally, he kind of just remembered that he didn't really like mainstream journalists to begin with, and then wondered, like, why am I doing business with this guy? And so he texted Don Lemon's agent and said, no, like, contract is canceled. And in so doing, in that, like, again, it's very Elon, because if you're Elon Musk, you can sort of just decide that's what you want to do, and you don't have to consult anybody, and you can just sort of leave your team to figure out whether or not you actually have to pay Don Lemon, which is still ongoing. But in the process, you kind of jettison this whole business that you were going to stand up, where you were going to invite content creators other than the most sort of like fringe and lunatic voices to come be on the platform, right? Because if you are the next Don Lemon and Elon is inviting you to come start a show and make, you know, $2 million a year doing it, why would you do that if you know that, like, the moment he decides he doesn't like you asking tough questions or doing the actual practice of journalism, that he might just cancel the contract? So in a way, this was sort of a blow to Don Lemon, although I do think he's going to get his money. And he definitely got more attention and 15 minutes of fame than he might otherwise have gotten. But I also think it's sort of a blow, at least if not to Elon, to Linda Yaccarino and her hopes of bringing advertisers back onto the platform through these sorts of deals.
Yeah, I mean, watching the interview excerpts, it's pretty cringe, man. I mean, Don is asking these questions. Elon is very uncomfortable, doesn't want to be there. It just reminded me of the fact that, you know, he owns and has built all these successful tech companies and deserves credit for that. Tesla, SpaceX, et cetera, Neuralink. But, like, Twitter Threads, the, like, centerpiece of the public conversation, and is in many ways like partly a media company. And so, you know, by acquiring X, he's suddenly thrust himself even further into the public discourse, the media crosshairs, and he's just not a media person and not a social media person, despite pretending to know all about everything. And it's just yet another reminder that, like, while you can build something like Neuralink, which is insanely impressive, you know, running a social media / media platform is a very different thing. And, like, you know, it's kind of like Bill Ackman putting all that money into Dean Phillips. It's like, just because you're rich doesn't mean you know everything and can do everything. And, you know, I want to fast forward like 2 years to see where Twitter is, because everyone's always like, Twitter's dying. There's some, like, the For You page on Twitter, by the way, like, and my friends who are liberals even admit this, it's pretty good. Like, it's, the targeting's getting better. Like, there are things about, and by the way, also, people haven't flocked to Threads. Threads is not the place where people are going for sports and news and breaking news, et cetera. Like, people are still coming back to Twitter/X. I'm sure engagement time spent is down. I'm sure they've lost a lot of DAU. Certainly revenue is down. But, like, there are some things that aren't completely dying. I'm anxious to see where this goes in 2 years and if Elon does just give it up at some point, because it's still the skeletons, the bones of it could still be something, but he just seems like the wrong person to be running it.
Yeah. It also does, to your point about Threads, it is, and maybe someone smarter than myself can explain this at some point, it doesn't seem like it should be terribly hard if it feels like one social, you know, instant social media platform that is the town square, if that place seems to be burning or is mired in controversy, it doesn't seem like it would be all that hard, especially if you are someone like Mark Zuckerberg, to stand up another one. And yet no one, that Threads doesn't seem to have fulfilled that mission. And no one else seems to be really trying in a meaningful way that could really supplant Twitter's dominance in that space.
Yeah.
And I don't know why that is.
Sorry to be a tech guy here, but like Threads and Meta did something pretty sly a couple months ago, which is they said their prized metric is monthly active users, MAU, instead of DAU, yeah, which is really the prized metric, daily active users.
Yeah.
And they said they have like 150 million monthly active users, meaning that many people are like bouncing into the app once a month, probably because they're being prompted on Instagram. They have not released their daily user figure in a very long time. I'm interested to know what it is, because like other than some hardo liberals and journalists who are rooting for Threads very hard, there's not that many normies on Threads, I can promise you that. And like people have Twitter X, lots of people left, but a lot of people just have it in their daily habit going back 10, 15 years, and that's a hard habit to break and just migrate over to a new platform that's just basically copycatting. Anyway, Dylan, thanks for joining me, buddy.
Thank you, Peter. Great to see you this week.
Thanks so much for listening to another episode of The Powers That Be. As a reminder, The Powers That Be is the official podcast of Puck. We'd like to thank Ben Landy, Liz Goff, and Alex Bigler for their editorial and production guidance. If you like what you hear, please share with a friend. It really helps us keep delivering the inside scoop that only Puck can offer. Follow us on Twitter at Puck News. I'm Ben Landy. See you tomorrow. This has been a presentation of Odyssey. Please listen, rate, review, and follow all episodes wherever you get your podcasts. The Powers That Be Daily is executive produced by John Kelly, co-founder of Puck, Bob Tabador, and Ben Landy, executive editor at Puck.